Welcome, everybody, to the Brian Foltis Behavioral Finance Podcast. My name is Dr. Brian Foltis, and I'm an associate professor of finance at Butler University in Indianapolis, Indiana. My goal is to help you make better financial decisions with your money. I am here to teach you on this podcast in the area of behavioral finance. I believe this is an often overlooked area of finance that I have yet to see somebody comprehensively put together enough content to call it behavioral finance. Well, this is my main area of research, and I also teach this course each semester at Butler. And so I figured there should be an outlet to provide behavioral finance for free. I'm teaching corporate finance online this summer. Behavioral finance is what I am here to talk to you about. So this podcast is not affiliated with Butler, and the content and my ridiculous stories have nothing to do with that institution or my job. That's just all me. Today, we are going to simply set a foundation, a getting to know you episode on what you're about to get into with this podcast, with the content, and the person behind this content as well. So this is our introduction to the podcast. I've had a lot of people in my world that are interested in this area, and they always wanted to learn more. And I looked online, and I really couldn't find any good resources for them to go to. Anything was really either a small snippet or one particular subject within behavioral finance, and there really wasn't anything that I found real suitable. And even I think it was Robert Shiller has a lecture that he was doing behavioral economics, and he's the Yale professor, the Shiller Index, the Case-Shiller Index, that is real estate index. He made it. And so I think, oh, wow, that's really excited to listen to this lecture, and realize that his attempt to teach prospect theory, it didn't really even make sense. And so I am going to try to right that wrong. No pressure. But that's a big part of behavioral finance. The content is around this prospect theory. So I'm fired up. I'm excited to teach this, get the content out. There's so much to talk about and so much to learn, and I'm ready to go. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and just needed to get this online, and I'll put my face up here. So if you're on YouTube, hello world, this is me. And if you're listening on your podcast, I'll post this on podcast areas as well. So if you're heading to work, from work, walking the dog, we're going to learn a little bit about behavioral finance and hopefully be entertained at the same time. That's the idea. And I'm going to structure a lot of this content similarly to my courses. So if you were to take my behavioral finance course in the spring or the fall, we just take the first class time to get to know each other, to understand who we are, and then we defer that introduction topic to the next class. So again, Brian Foltis, I am an associate professor of finance, was tenured 3 years ago. Yeah, 3 years ago now, and I'm just finished my eighth year there, and very, very blessed, very fortunate to be in that position. I get to teach awesome students and just be hopefully a positive part in their life, even if it's just a little bit for a semester or two, and then send them on their way. And one thing I like about behavioral finance is It's usually one of the elective courses. So, like I said, I'm teaching corporate finance. That's the main finance course that everybody at the business school takes. But I also teach investments. I'll teach international finance as well, talking about currencies and all that fun risk management stuff. And those are the two main classes I teach in addition to, or actually three now, and then behavioral finance as well. But behavioral finance is the one that we talk about, all these models and the capital asset pricing model, the Fama-French model, and we say, oh, this is the gospel. This, we all assume all these things about every single investor. And then we take the time in behavioral to say, hey, wait a minute, we have some questions about it. So the way I teach behavioral finance is not in a way that demeans what's been done in classical finance, and but it's a way to ask questions around it and to use our behavioral biases in complement to the models that are already out there, not to disregard them, but to add some color to it, add some questions as to the validity, but not to completely disregard it. So that's where I think some of the misconceptions come from. And that's why behavioral finance, you don't see it in a lot of different universities, because I think some people are so rigid to their beliefs in their models that anybody who questions it should be cast away. And I'm okay being cast away, especially in the academic finance community. Every time I go to one of those conferences, I look it around and go, am I one of those people? Am I this? Go, no. Okay. No. Anyway, my background, I'm a boy from Grand Rapids, Michigan. So that's where I was born and raised, up in Grand Rapids. That is the west side of Michigan. And went all the way. I stayed in Grand Rapids all the way through college and through the end of college, and actually played big in sports. So played small college two sports for a couple of years, and then played basketball at a pretty high level. We had some pretty good success, and so I was a point guard, and I guess, what was I? A three-time All-State and a couple-time All-American. And so with that success, I walked away from college with a degree in business administration. And what that meant in business administration is that I could do anything in business, but I also couldn't do anything in business. And I didn't really know what to do. So the only thing I knew what to do at that time with any validity or significance was to shoot a basketball. So I kept playing, and found a team over in Germany who called me that summer as I was getting ready to get a big boy job. They called me over, and they wanted me to play professionally over in Germany. So I jumped at the chance. That was my dream. I wanted to play, and ended up just playing that year. Had great success. We ended up winning the championship. And that night when we were having our party, the president of the team actually told me that when he called me on the summer, that summer before, that he had intended to call another guy out of the UK and offer him the job, but he ended up by mistake thinking it was him, so he gave me the job. And he said that was the best mistake he's ever made during that time. So we went back and decided, you know what, I was 23 at the time. My lower back was feeling like it was 43 at that time, so ended up just going back home, and we moved to Florida. This was me and my ex-wife, where we were married when we were 21. What could go wrong there, right? So we were 23 and lived in Germany, had a good experience, moved to Florida where we lived, and ended up feeling about 5 years later, after living in Florida, I got back in shape and went back and played basketball again. So my time in Florida, I started my own business and ended up working at Fidelity Investments as an advisor, and then teaching some of the training classes. Was doing that for a while. Went and got my MBA at a local university, and worked at Deutsche Bank in investment banking. Was on the derivatives settlement, so back office team, working on derivatives, and really was struggling finding my purpose. I worked really hard in the derivatives center, and was thinking to myself, where am I going to go with this in the next 10 to 15 years? And what I likened that the job and my career to is in that area. When you're in derivatives, it's a so somebody wins, somebody loses, and it all nets to zero. So we call this a zero sum game when we're dealing with options and derivatives. And I felt like my job was a zero sum game, where I would go and I would work really hard in the morning digging a hole, and I would take a lunch break, I'd come back, fill that hole in, and I'd go home, and I'd get paid pretty well. And I got promoted. I was going to be the manager of the team, and I was just like, this can't be it. This can't be what finance is. There's got to be more. I want to actually help people. But at Fidelity, I also didn't want to get yelled at every day by people who were during the financial crisis. I lost the money. Call me up. You lost me money. My Magellan fund, you lost me money. And we talk about reference point dependence in this class, where they say that we lost them 50% because they had $500,000 and now they only have $250,000. And I say, well, you change your reference point, you can look back into the 1980s, you only put $10,000 into this. So you should be thanking me instead that I increased your, well, I didn't do any of it, but your money has increased from 10,000 to 250,000, instead of moving your reference point at different times. So anyway, after being berated a number of times, I still wanted to help people. But just didn't know exactly what that meant. All I knew is I needed to find a bigger purpose. And so I felt that getting my doctorate and doing that would propel me to kind of get me out of this lower level race and give me some sort of significance in this area. And I always felt that I was just getting bored, and I didn't want to be bored either. And so that's why I was looking at a pretty good challenge and of trying to get a PhD. So started looking around, and I thought, well, let's look in Germany again, see if they have it, because they don't pay tuition. And then I'll get back in shape and I'll play basketball again. So I worked incredibly hard, got in the best shape of my life. This was now I'm about 28, 29 years old. And got in good shape, went back and found a place in Germany that was University of Münster. And this was a really good university, and they wanted to give me a try. And so I thought to myself, the plan was they were going to give me a shot for 6 months. A team was going to give me a shot to play for them for a year. And all we had to do is pick up, move ourselves over there, pick up our entire lives, quit our jobs. At that time, I had a 13-month-year-old baby and also a dog. So we're going to pick everybody up and move to Germany again for a long time, potentially, or not. So we think about cost-benefit analysis and trying to make decisions. After all, we are a sum of all decisions we've ever made. Where we are today is a sum total of every decision we've ever made. So that's why I'm also interested in behavioral finance, to try to make the best decisions and understand some of our deficiencies of why we don't make great decisions. Nevertheless, we thought to ourselves, what would happen if things went disastrous? We picked up everything, we moved, and it didn't go well. We would be right back to where we were in a similar job doing similar things 6 to 12 months later. Well, when we started thinking about that, I said, we gotta go do this. So we went. And I'll never forget my first conversation with my dissertation father. They call it disfata. So that was my dissertation dad or whatever you call him. And the supervisor. He says to me, this is Professor Thomas Longer. He says to me, Brian, I don't doubt that you're going to be a good teacher. Don't think I'm going to have any doubts there. He said, but unless you have 2 to 3 A-rated journal publications, you're not going to get your doctorate from me. Oh, okay, that's fine. Publications, I can get published. 2 to 3 A journals, is that what, that's all you need? Okay. And I kind of dismissed it. I didn't think it was a big deal. I was there to learn. I was there to... What he actually told me, and once I figured this out, was A journals are very, very difficult. And, no, let's rephrase this. He told me, you need to come up with an idea in the world of finance. We're all behavioral finance guys. And that nobody ever came up with in the whole profession. And you need to formalize it, quantify it, prove that this is valid. And then you also have to be right about it. So that's when it kind of hit me that research is about coming up with ideas that nobody else has thought of before. And also clever ideas that you can execute and prove and then also be right. So later on down the line, I was told that, you know, for every A journal, you are going to have 5 right ideas. And for every 5 right ideas, you're going to have 20 other ideas. Wait, what was the number? No, they said for every 20 ideas, you will be right 1 or 2 of the times. And so I just thought to myself, okay, well, I guess I just need to be right 1 or 2 times, but then I need to come up with 60 to 100 ideas in order to get this doctorate that I picked up my entire life for, moved 5,000 miles to get. And sure enough, it was very challenging, but man, it paid off. So I played basketball there for 2 seasons while I did the doctorate. Realized that my old 5'10 body was just not cut out for a long-term basketball professional career. And so now I just moved, and we were 5 years there in total. So the last 3 years were spent finishing out the dissertation and working on my doctorate. So 5 years in total. And now the good news is I'm 42. I don't have any nagging injuries, thank goodness. And came back home with that doctorate. Now, coming back home, it was time to leave Germany. And after 5 years, we loved it there, but it was time to come back. So it was time to find a job, and you had to decide, are you going to go back to industry, go back to investment banking, or do you want to stay in academia? And for me, the answer was pretty clear. We're going to stay in academia. And applied for 90 different universities in the United States who are hiring that year. Ended up getting about 10 to 12 interviews. And then ended up finding my favorite application was reciprocated. They liked me back and they gave me the offer. So it was a very easy decision to go to Butler, as I felt like I was back at home. So that's how I found myself at Butler. And what's interesting though about behavioral finance is my time there. So I was talking to these customers at Fidelity over and over again. You lost me this money. And I'm like, why are they so like, why their veracity was way more than the conversations that we had when their money was going up. And when we're starting to talk about prospect fit theory, you start realizing, oh, well, that's loss aversion. So people feeling losses X times more than they'll feel their gains. I go, oh, that's what Mr. and Mrs. Smith were so mad about. Their loss aversion is, I don't know, 5 to 10 times. So they're feeling these losses 5 to 10 times more than they're going to be appreciative of any gains. So it just started clicking for me, and I realized that I found my purpose, and it was to help people, maybe not even one-on-one, but to help people through education of behavioral finance. And then also in some of the research, we talk about some of the retirement design. So how do you design retirement plans or savings plans in order to assist people in pushing them into the right decision, not without being too aggressive, but also setting defaults, because we know that people procrastinate and they'll just settle into whatever default is set out for them. Oh, anyway, fast forward here. I've got my oh, see the 13-month-old is now 13 years old, and I've got two boys now, and I live in suburbia, Indianapolis in Indiana, and I have a fiance now, and so and my 10-year-old, I have two boys, so my life consists mainly of being an unpaid Uber driver, taking him back and forth from track, basketball, soccer all year round. And I'm not mad about it. I love this chapter of life. I feel very fortunate. Be getting married here at the end of the summer, having a new house. So I'm happy to share my life. And I just know that when I was growing up financially, I was from a middle class family. Dad was a middle school math teacher, and my mom was part-time insurance agent. And growing up, we never talked ever about money. And it was just a taboo thing. It was rude. You didn't talk about it. And that was that. So, of course, I go out into the real world into my 20s, and I did everything wrong because I didn't know any better. Take out a student loan. Yep, check. Even though I was playing basketball and was on scholarship there, I had a little extra spending money. Why not? And then I started a business in Florida. I was doing a commercial cleaning company. So put that on credit card, car loan, you got it. And then just start a job working behind the desk at the same time. So I ended up going into my late 20s. So I was 27 years old. 27 years old, and I'll never forget. This was December 27th, and I was 27 years old, and my credit card or my debt, overall debt altogether, was at $27,000, and I was just about 27 pounds overweight. All these things, playing professional basketball when I was 23. We're going in the wrong direction. I was going backwards financially. My body was going backwards. And I just said, I can't keep going like this. So it was on a car trip from my ex-in-laws. in Fort Lauderdale up to where we were living in Jacksonville, where it was this breakthrough moment of enough's enough. It's time to work out of this. It's time to get out of debt. It's time to get back in shape. I don't accept what is happening here. And it was after that where I had that enough is enough breakthrough moment in my car where we set out the next month. And I ended up doing a Daniel fast through my church that next month in 21 days. And when you're in your late 20s, you do a Daniel fast, like for real Daniel fast. That is fruits, vegetables, beans. I guess you can do beans for protein. And that was also coffee. Everything else was cut out. Ended up dropping that weight pretty quickly. I was down about 25 pounds by the end of that month. But then it was all about getting myself back in shape. I ended up at that time, I stopped. I ended up selling my business, worked at Fidelity during the day, and then cleaned the profitable contracts at night. So these were just monster days. I worked my ass off for about 12 to 16 months. Working during the day, dinner, clean at night, come home and repeat over and over. And in those 12 months, we were able to get ourselves all the way out of debt. And also, we had an emergency fund, which was about $10,000 to $12,000 an emergency fund. And because of that, we believe that actually opened up the door for us to go to Germany. And had we not done that, we wouldn't have been able to really somehow justify going and picking up our lives to do a risky endeavor because we just couldn't, that didn't make any sense. So we ended up doing, after that phase, that changed the whole trajectory of our finances. And we haven't looked back since then. And I'm thinking now, too, with those student loans, man, you're 42 years old. If you don't pay that off early, that would you'd be making your final loans now. Oh, I'm so thankful. I do not regret those 12 to 16 months of putting in those extra hours because that changed everything. So anyway, my parents, bless their hearts, never talked about money. I made all the mistakes, had to read all the books on my own, get educated all on my own, and it was a rough path. So can you imagine when I have young students and have the opportunity to speak to them about making financial decisions? I tell them that you have somebody to talk to now. That I call it the Foltis lifetime guarantee. That if you take one of my courses, then you have me to as a support system for life. And I know some of the students who are like juniors and seniors, there's like, I can't wait to be done with your class. Just get me the hell out of here. I don't care. I don't ever want to see you again. I understand that. But anybody else who comes back, they can always reach out to me. And every year I count and kind of use it as a gauge for how am I connecting with people. And I always like to see that number grow if we as we have more and more graduates now after 8 years, students who come back and just have a question about a retirement question or a savings question or just a life question. I really value that. I never really had that support, and I want to be that support to my students, listeners, as this grows, to be that kind of resource that can assist people. And so that's what I'm here for. That's what gets me excited, fired up. And now the introduction's over. We're gonna teach this stuff. So just a couple of highlights here. We're gonna do an introduction, and the next time, bringing us from where we used to evaluate expected value to expected utility into prospect theory. So breaking some of these violations down to get us to prospect theory. And then we've got material coming up on market efficiency and some of the different anomalies around market efficiency. And after that, we've got a very long section on different biases and different heuristics. So these are our mental shortcuts that we make time and time again, starting from when we wake up to when we go to bed. And then that kind of bleeds into some overconfidence content. And we'll be doing a bunch of retirement. And then it's all about trying to be aware of our own biases. And then finally, try to minimize those and help others, whether it's your clients or family members, partners, whatever, to help minimize these biases in order to make more rational decisions. So with that, I am going to log off. And if you have questions or anything you want to talk about, please leave a comment below. You can reach me at brianfoltis.com or hunt me down on Instagram. I'm there too. I haven't decided if I'm going to be on, if I'm deeming myself too young to be on Facebook, even though I know I'm not. I think I'm too old to be on Snapchat and TikTok. So I'm kind of finding myself in this YouTube, Instagram space. So hopefully you can find me there and let me know what you want to hear. Let me know how I can serve you. And thanks for watching. Please make sure you subscribe and don't miss out on this future videos because we're gonna learn something, I promise, coming up.